It probably comes as no surprise to many of you that I am not a fan of liver. I don't care how you dress it up, I will never eat it knowingly. When served it as a child in a home where you ate everything on your plate, who came from a house like that? There you go. I would groan, smother it with onions, pinch my nose, and when my parents left the kitchen, feed it to a dog or throw it in the trees or outside of our kitchen at great risk of getting caught. You know, it's not easy to slip a dog liver and get away with it. Or, you know, my mother, after we'd have a dinner of liver, would wonder why the dog would like those trees so much afterwards. And by the way, pea soup and tuna casserole had the same reaction from me. But in some ways, I think the book of Leviticus is like the liver of the Bible. How many enthusiastic readings of the scriptures are stalled there after being captivated by Genesis and Exodus, where we groan, pinch our noses, and try to make a way through? Well, I hope as we begin our study of this third book of the Bible, it becomes much better than that. But as we start our adventure there, and I would like us to see it as an adventure, trying to make through something that apparently seems to be so difficult, that we really do need to look backwards. We really do have to think of the God that has presented himself in the book of Genesis and Exodus. Because you know something? If we are not struck by him, if we are not aware of him, if we don't know that the God of Genesis and Exodus is where Leviticus is coming from, if we're not struck by his power, if we're not awed by his grandeur, if we're not captured by his love, like if we don't realize that it's the God of creation that's the God of Leviticus, this God that spoke things into being. It's the God of covenant and promise, the one who protected Abraham and made a relationship with him. He is the God of the flood. He is the one that takes sin seriously. He is the God of the plagues of Egypt and the Exodus and the provision that is in the wanderings in the desert. And naturally, he is the God of Sinai. It was there, actually, at Sinai, in an awesome demonstration of power, an experience of sight and sound, the lightning flashing, the thunder rumbling, the Israelites quaking in their boots, literally. And again, God is giving his law to Moses up on high. So again, we cannot dismiss the relationship we have with God, the knowledge of God from our study of the law. I mean, how many fears we face, insecurities we struggle with, and problems we have because we do not understand or believe who he is. You know, here in your presence, we are undone, some of us just sang. Hopefully you meant it. Again, that's the only conclusion. Struck by Isaiah, the train of God's robe filling the temple. And I'm a sinful man in the presence of a sinful people. What would I do without the God who you are? Where would I be if you weren't the kind of God that you are? Well, it is that God that hovers over the book of Leviticus and that we bring with us there. Now, for our study, I will not be reading the text per se, but will be expressing it in the highlights that I give you. If you were to read, you will see in the slides that I will now provide, it is a good synopsis of what is there. As we go through these, we will actually cover the material in the first 7 chapters of the book. And so if you could actually put up that first picture, let's go with the picture first before the slide, because a lot of what we will see expressed in the sacrificial system or what God describes, again, different things will be referenced. When you see this brazen altar in the middle of the picture here, that is where that is where all the sacrifices are being made. A lot of the activity of animals being sacrificed or grain being put on the altar is there. You'll find one reference in terms of the sin offering, where there'll be engagement with the tent of meeting or the inner sanctum. Now, that is what is pictured in the back there. Now, remember, the first part of that that inner sanctum, the tent of meeting, is something the priest could enter throughout the year. And then the back is that Holy of Holies. So, in other words, the Holy of Holies was a separate place within that tent of meeting and that's where the priest could go in the front. But then only the high priest once a year would enter the Holy of Holies. And we saw that in the book of Leviticus. So now let's go to our first slide, because if you were to read through the book of Leviticus and start there, you're going to see a series of offerings. And basically, what I have in these slides are the directions, the information that's around each one of them, and I present them just like the book of Leviticus does. Not necessarily in the order of priority, because I figure in some ways, by Leviticus presenting it in this way, it's giving us the priority. And so therefore, you see here all the different dynamics. Now, something that does happen in terms of if you were to read through the book of Leviticus, a lot of these instructions are in those first few chapters. Then what happens in the later chapters, like 1 through 3 and then 4 through 7, it goes into instructions for the priests about the different offerings. So you'll read in chapter 1 about the burnt offerings. Then around chapter 4, 5, you'll see some more instruction about the burnt offering. Well, what is going to distinguish those two is one is the instructions for the offerer. What does this offering mean? What are the activities that involve that? Then there'll be further instruction for the priest for that. So, just reading through these, and I'll make comment as we go along, and I'll try to refrain as much as I can. But first and foremost, the burnt offering seems to be for intentional sin. And it's just interesting in that first comment, there's a little bit of disagreement among scholars in terms of just what the burnt offering was. To the extent the burnt offering was a separate offering that, again, was for intentional sin, that it actually brought atonement. You'll find that word in the first chapter of Leviticus. Or whether the burnt offering is kind of an overall description of all the offerings described where things are burned. And naturally, everything at some point in time in terms of these offerings are burnt. Now, what I find interesting when we do get to the sin offering and the guilt offering, none of those are expressly given for intentional sin. So I think to myself, certainly there are times that I do things that are wrong that are unintentional. There are plenty of times that I do things wrong that are intentional. And so therefore, when in this first offering, there is this thought of atonement that is offered, and how I would distinguish this offering from the other offerings, particularly around sin, that's why I come with that first designation. This seems to be the offering that's given for intentional sins. Well, and this will make more sense when we go through the sin and the guilt offering. But again, it expresses bringing a male without defect, again, the perfectness of the provision of the sacrifice that reflects the perfectness of God, and how, again, the offerings are given in this context because we've broken that. See, if atonement is necessary, that means that something has been broken. A relationship has been compromised. I've done something in defiance and broken a law, and something has to be made to fix that. So again, it seems to be for intentional sin that the offering would be a male without defect. The offerer would lay his hands on the offering to make atonement. A lot of these offerings have people putting their hands on the offering. There was definitely something God intended for the people of Israel to identify what this animal is suffering. That ultimately there was definitely an awareness that this bull, this goat, this sheep, this ox, this ram is suffering what I should suffer. The substitutionary aspect of the offerings of God is reinforced right from the get-go in terms of what the Israelites' understanding would be about how God deals with sin. The blood will be sprinkled on all sides of the altar. The offering is to be skinned and cut into pieces. The pieces, and again, it says this specifically, so that's why it's here. The pieces, including the head and the fat, are placed on the fire. The inner parts and legs will be washed and all of it burned. That's an important part of the burnt offering, that it's a complete sacrifice. Nothing is given to the priest. Nothing is given to the worshiper that happens in the other offerings. Everything is given and everything is burnt. And an expression in terms of number 8 there is something that happens pretty consistently with these offerings. The aroma pleasing to the Lord. What I want you to do the next time you're barbecuing, next time you throw a steak on the grill, I want you to think of the book of Leviticus. Because as you're over in the yard or maybe your neighbor's cooking steak and you start, oh, isn't that a nice aroma? That's what God is talking about. In fact, he specifically says, it doesn't come up here, that don't eat fat, you sacrifice the fat on the altar. You know what burning fat smells like? Awesome! Right? Right? And so what we have to understand is that God does not have a nose. You know, Jesus has a nose, but God the Father is spirit. But in fact, the fact that he talks about an aroma pleasing to the Lord, he knows. See, what I imagine, these offerers offer these offerings, and they start smelling and say, wow, this really smells good. Well, just understand that God is internalizing what we're experiencing and saying, you know something? When you want to please the Lord, just understand, when you offer this offering, you smell it as being pleasing, it's pleasing to me too. That it's an aroma pleasing to the Lord. And the pleasing part of this is that sin is being atoned for. The relationship is being restored. What was broken is being fixed. The animal is a substitute between the offerer and God. And so again, that's the fact that God is pleased by that. Sheep, goats, a dove, or pigeon are also accepted in terms of the first one, it should have been a bull. The bull is mentioned first, but then sheep, goats, dove, or pigeons are also accepted in terms of the burnt offering. The burnt offering is to remain on the altar throughout the night, and the fire must be kept burning. And just the awareness of the offering and God's willingness to make atonement is a consistent presence among the people. And I think that's the significance of the fire burning, is that God is always willing to make atonement. God is always available. Oh, the door is always open. 24/7, God is available. And just 11, the last point under the burnt offering, again, that comes out in chapter 5 or 6, I can't remember which it is. The priest then, with linen cloths, shall remove the ashes of the burnt offering and place them besides the altar. He is then to put on other clothes and carry the ashes outside the camp to a place that is ceremonially clean. You know, holiness, we're going to see, is an important part of the whole book of Leviticus, and certainly in the process of these offerings. So the fact that the priest would wear special clothes as he's dealing with this holy sacrifice, this holy transaction that has been happened between offerer and God through the sacrifice. So when even the ashes of that sacrifice are being dealt with, it has to be dealt with a special clothing that the priest is wearing. But then the neat picture here in terms of taking in the ashes outside the camp is that once atonement is made, once a sacrifice is given, then we're separate from it. That now it's taken away from us, and there's it's casting into the sea of forgetfulness. It's remembering it no more in terms of the process being complete. With the burnt offering, with the people. So let's go with the next slide now. The next offering that's talked about in Leviticus is the grain offering. This seems to be for a praise or thank offering as well as provision for the priests. When it talks about what the material would be used in the offering, it would be fine flour with oil and incense, a memorial portion burned on the altar, again, an aroma pleasing to the Lord. And think about how incense, you know, we like incense, God likes incense. Again, people doing things particularly that, again, create a good aroma for them, and God, you know, recognizing that and affirming that in the way that he responds. You know, what's interesting is the rest is given to Aaron and his sons. They are to eat it in the courtyard of the tent of meeting. Any male descendant of Aaron may eat it. So when it comes to the grain offering, again, this is not about sin. This is not about atonement. This is not about fixing something that's broken. This is really reveling in who God is in terms of praising him or thanking him. And there was also a provision for the priests in this. If the grain offering is baked and brought, it is to be without yeast, spread with oil, and have no honey. Yeast and honey could be included in the offering of first fruits, but not as pleasing aroma to the Lord. and we know what the significance is of terms of yeast in terms of that representing sin and corruption. Maybe I'm thinking honey just doesn't smell good when it's burnt. We'll have to try that out. When the priest is anointed, he is to bring 2 quarts of fine flour, half in the morning, half in the evening. They are to prepare it with oil on a griddle. When a priest offers a grain offering, it is to be burned completely. It must not be eaten. So you see the dynamic here? That ultimately a worshiper brings a grave offering. There's kind of a token aspect that's thrown on the altar. The rest is given to the priest, but now when the priest is giving a grain offering, see, what it doesn't do, it's not like, okay, the priest says, well, you know something, I want to offer something to God, but I really want to keep something for myself too, so let me give a grain offering so I get some of the offering. No, God says, no, if you're bringing it, then ultimately it must be burned completely because you cannot be benefited by an offering that, again, you're giving to God in praise or thanks. Let's move on to the next slide. The next is described in the book of Leviticus is the fellowship or peace offering. This is to reinforce the fellowship that we have with God and with each other. Notice here it is a male or female without defect. Again, that without defect, whenever an animal is being brought, is something that's consistent with all the sacrifices. But here, a female is allowed in terms of what people would choose to bring because what is being reinforced, again, it's not atonement. It's not fixing something that's been broken, but rather it's rejoicing in the fellowship that we have with God. Again, there's a praise and a thank aspect of that, but the relationship and appreciation and valuing that relationship is what is expressed here. Once again, it's the hand of the offering on the head of the animal, blood on all sides of the altar. All the fat that covers the inner parts, the kidneys and the covering of the liver is burned. It is burned on top of the burnt offering. And so as the burnt offering is made, the fellowship and peace offering, because of atonement being given and the appreciation for the fellowship that's restored, is what this is about. Again, it's an aroma pleasing to the Lord. It is also burned as food for both the priest and the worshiper. The priest is to receive the breast and the right thigh. This is in chapter 7. He is to wave both before the Lord to thank and recognize the Lord for his provision. Again, this is, I know this is kind of hard to go through. This is the best way that I can at least make it an adventure, right? Isn't this fun? No. I don't know to what extent different people are going to be hit by this stuff. I think there just should be a curiosity. Well, all scriptures God breathed and is useful for correction and training. And all those other words in 2 Timothy 3, I don't know, it's escaping me now. But it's all useful in terms of the man of God being equipped by God for the service that we perform. And so therefore, we have to recognize the value of the information that is here, whether we recognize it or not. But when we see this aspect of the priest waving the breast and the thigh before God, again, this is the provision. It's not a sin offering. It's not for atonement. This is someone reflecting on the fellowship that has been restored, the gratitude towards God because of that. And what I think is important about this is that the priest is showing the fact that he internalizes that it's not the offerer that has given him something. So the offerer brings an offering. The priest is getting a portion from that. Wouldn't it be tempting for you as a priest to go to the offer and say, hey, thank you. Thank you for that ox or that sheep or that bull that you brought to me. I'm grateful that, you know, my family's hungry and now they can be fed by this. What this is recognizing, what the priest is recognizing by waving it before the Lord is it's not from the offerer. It's from the Lord, that the Lord is the one that decides you get a portion of that. So therefore, the person to be thanked isn't the offer, but God. This is the only offering that the worshiper is given a portion. That's very significant. Again, as we reflect on our fellowship with God, as we enjoy that fellowship with God, as we give a sacrifice in the context of that fellowship with God, we also have to understand that God values fellowship amongst ourselves. You know, oftentimes the Jewish people would not kill an animal for food. you know, it would be used for other tasks and other labors that it would assist the Israelites in terms of their agriculture and such. So it was pretty special for them to kill an animal and to have a feast for their family or for their friends. And so therefore, something that commentators bring out is that as a worshiper is given a portion of this, this is not only reinforcing the fellowship they have with God, but the fellowship they have with other people. That the fellowship offering is of thanks and must all be eaten the same day. If it's a result of a vow or a freewill offering, it can also be eaten the next day. It needs to be burned on the third day. And then the emphasis, you know, a few times in the book of Leviticus, you must not eat any fat or blood. Again, fat and blood mean different things to God. You know, blood is something that is associated with forgiveness. It's associated with atonement. Fat is associated with a pleasing aroma to God. So those things are for God. Those things are oriented to Him. So you don't eat them and try to, you know, I wonder, you know, for you health people, for people that, you know, cut the fat off their meat and don't want to eat that's for you. You know, God is reinforcing you shouldn't eat fat because it becomes part of you. The next slide, please. Okay, then the next section we get to is the sin offering. I had a sense we wouldn't get through all of these. This is, again, to me, this is a very interesting part of the book of Leviticus. Because as you read through the chapter and a half, almost two chapters covering the sin offering, it is all talking about unintentional sin. Again, it's things that you did that were wrong, that you didn't know when you were doing it that it was wrong, but then you become aware of it, and because you've become aware of it, now God is requiring a sacrifice from you. Again, so it's strange to me that the sin offering is talking about unintentional sins. Well, then what do you do for intentional sins? Like, did that not happen to the people of Israel? That's why I say the burnt offering has to be for intentional sins, because atonement is mentioned here. But again, if you read, what is this, chapter 3, 4? Again, you will see this, you know, constantly saying, for unintentional sins, for unintentional sins. Now, what's significant about that, though, is that even when you do not intend to sin, even if it's something that again, is something you do by mistake or oversight, it's still sin. It still has to be dealt with. In other words, in God's economy, in the way God perceives that, the fact that you weren't aware of it doesn't change what you've done. You know, just because you hit the baseball in an errant way and it hits the window, you didn't mean to do that. You were trying to get a single, or you're trying to get a home run. You're not trying to break a car window, but you still did it, right? It's still the effect of that. And so God is again reinforcing the importance of, again, just the whole idea of mistake and error and sin, in terms of addressing it, even if it's unintended. Now, it goes into lengthy conversation about who in the Israelite community is giving this offering, who has committed that kind of sin. If it's the priest, he is to bring a young bull without defect, lay his hand on its head, take blood into the tent of meeting, then dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle it seven times before the Lord in front of the curtain of the sanctuary. Over other blood goes on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense in the tent of meeting. The rest of the bull's blood is poured out on the base of the altar of the burnt offering at the entrance of the tent of meeting, that the fat, kidneys, and covering of the liver to be removed, just like the fellowship offering. They are then burned on the altar of burnt offering. All the rest of the bull is to be taken outside the camp to a place that is ceremonially clean, where the ashes are thrown and burn it on a wood fire on the ash heap. So again, this whole reinforcement of blood being spilt, there being a recognition, a special recognition in terms of horns being blood being put on the halls, or the horns of the altar, but then separating that sin in the sacrifice. And again, being removed from the covenantal relationship with God in terms of what's represented in that tent of meeting, and putting it outside of the community and killing it there. Now, if the whole Israelite community, even if they are unaware of it, they are guilty, When they become aware, they are to bring a young bull. The same procedure is used as above, but as the elders of Israel that lay the hands on the bull rather than the priest. But still, it's a sprinkling of seven times. It's the blood on the horns of the altar. Now, if it's a leader in the community, he is to bring a male goat without defect, slaughtered in the place the burnt offering is. The blood is spread on the horns of the altar and poured out the base, but no sprinkling seven times, also no taking the rest and burning it outside the camp. Go to the next slide. If it's a member of the community, he is to bring a female goat or lamb without defect. Same procedure as a leader, for both atonement is made and he will be forgiven. Again, that's what's important about these offerings. Again, it's about atonement. It's about gaining the forgiveness of God. Also covered in this section is a person who does not speak up when he hears a public charge to testify regarding something he has seen or learned about, and a person who touches something ceremonially unclean, the carcasses of unclean animals, even if he is unaware of it, as well as touching human uncleanliness, also someone who thoughtlessly takes an oath. Again, all the things that God is reinforcing, what he cares about, what he's valuing, what he's reinforcing to the Israelite community mentioned there. And you know something? This is a tough time to break in the middle, but it is a communion Sunday, and I think I'm going to do that. We will pick this up, but it's a good place, because you know something? To me, it just started getting heavy. Like, didn't it just, maybe for you 10 minutes ago, it stopped being an adventure? You know, and all, but now it's like, really? Like all this stuff and all the words and all the directions and all the things that are involved here? And just understand something, that the law was given not so that we could fulfill it. The law was given so that we couldn't fulfill it. And so when we think of this and think about, you know, what is this all about? What is this supposed to reinforce to us? Ultimately, it's the holiness of God and how without his provision, we'll never get there. See, I wonder when Christ came and he hung on the cross, and the book of Hebrews particularly points to the fact that he now is the final sacrifice. He is the one sacrificed once and for all. If all the animals said, hooray, you know, because if nothing else, and I, you know, I'll reinforce this in terms of my oversights, but, you know, in terms of the, I mean, all this was a very bloody affair in terms of all these sacrifices. And you wonder what, well, I don't think you have to wonder. I think it's clear what God wanted them to, what God wanted them to internalize, what he wanted them to understand about what was happening. That ultimately this gruesome, violent expression directed toward this animal was a necessary thing because that's how ugly sin is and that's how important relationship with God is. That something needs to happen. See, God doesn't just forget sin. God just doesn't pass it over. He just doesn't say, you know, something forget about it. I know you didn't really even mean it anyways. Or maybe you did, but we can just God doesn't overlook sin. There's always a prescribed path of us being made right with God. Naturally, the beauty of Christ and the reason why communion, when you're studying the book of Leviticus, is a wonderful thing for us to celebrate. Because ultimately, what Jesus has come to free us from is that. In terms of all the things that God would require us to do when we forsake his law, when we don't live in the obedience that he calls us to. You know, I'm struck when I read all these prescriptions for unintentional sin. I'm struck by 1 John 1:9. If we confess our sins, he's faithful and just to forgive our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So you understand that Jesus' death, his resurrection, was complete enough to cover it all. So as we read this, we get bored by it, we get confused by it, it gets muddled, and you know, you start sinking in your seat and your eyes start closing, whatever it is. that you have to understand that this is all pointing us, the people of Israel, God's intent, to the provision of Messiah, to Christ. There should have been a public hurrah from them. We don't need to do this anymore. We don't have to sacrifice of our wealth and the animals that we need for our agriculture or our families, whatever. That again, these are things that cost the people of Israel something. And so therefore, we don't need to do that anymore because Christ has come. And so when we consider the repetitive nature of these sacrifices, day in and day out, whenever you committed a sin, again, a sacrifice is required. Even when you didn't mean to do the sin and you become aware of it, a sacrifice is required. And so these things given weekly, daily, in terms of the participation of Israel in making things right with God, fixing what is broken, ultimately that's what Jesus came to make a provision for. And His blood being spilt and His life being given is, again, the ultimate substitute in terms of bringing atonement. You know, and that's what our celebration of communion is all about. It's looking at the elements. It's looking at the bread, which is representative of Christ's broken body. It's looking at the cup filled with grape juice that is intended to remind us of His blood. Again, that blood should mean more to us as you study the book of Leviticus than it ever meant before. In terms of all the blood that was spilt by animals to make things right, to fix the relationship with God, and then it's Jesus' blood that made that same provision. But to even have that part of our remembrance in terms of, and I think that blood just reinforces the giving of Jesus' life, the ultimate sacrifice that He was willing to give so that we could live. And so what I will do right now is I will ask the people passing out the communion to come. Whatever music, Mike, you might have provided for that can come. And then I'll just come and direct you in terms of taking the elements of the communion and praying. But I will say nothing more. And so what I would just ask you to do is use this for a time of reflection, appreciation, confession, in terms of recognizing the sacrifice of Christ, internalizing that personally, where you are in your relationship with Him, where you are in your relationship with each other, because all those things should be part of our celebration of communion. And so let's just pass out the elements.